This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, July 24, 2009. In Oaxaca, Mexico, I'm Shannon Young, sitting in for Manuel Rueda. The deadline to close the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center is fast approaching, with the fate of detainees still in question.
There have been some really worrying signs over the last few weeks and months that the administration thinks that in order to close Guantanamo, it needs to bring in some form of prolonged or preventative detention.
The federal minimum wage goes up today, but not all low-wage workers will benefit. And we'll take a look at civilian oversight of BART police in the wake of the Oscar Grant shooting.
There will be community oversight, period.
These stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Supporters of deposed Honduran President Manuel Zelaya are mobilizing once again to block major highways and demonstrate at educational and public institutions throughout Honduras. Hundreds of people also began moving towards Las Manos, a tiny isolated border crossing between Nicaragua and Honduras, in anticipation of ousted President Manuel Zelaya's possible return. Tim Russo brings us more from the border.
Thousands of Zelaya supporters in Honduras are moving towards the Nicaraguan border today. But to get there, they will have to make it through at least 8 military and police roadblocks. On Thursday, authorities along the 70-mile route between Tegucigalpa and the border stopped buses at gunpoint. 30 people, including Elias Mesa, were detained. Police allegedly held Mesa because he had given a ride to 10 people forced off their buses while trying to reach the border.
Metieron cerca de 15 personas de Tocoa, nosotros que somos de Danlí, también y fuimos golpeados, fuimos impuestos a las esposas.
They arrested 15 people from Tocoa and then us from Dandi. We were beaten and handcuffed. They ripped our shirts, then punched me in the face. And once I was cuffed, they threw me against the truck. They threatened to shoot us, and finally they took away our IDs.
Nos amenazaban ellos de que nos iban a disparar y decían de que les entregáramos las tarjetas de identidad.
At the border, the military imposed a 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. curfew to halt further movement by Zelaya sympathizers. Tim Russo, FSRN, Honduras.
Today, Zelaya traveled to the Nicaragua side of the border. In a statement to the press, he asked members of the Honduran military and police to allow him to cross back into his country. But as of FSRN airtime, the president had not attempted to cross. After a weapons cache exploded in southern Lebanon last week, a senior UN official says the Shiite Muslim party Hezbollah violated a UN Security Council resolution. FSRN's Jackson Allers reports.
UN head of peacekeeping operations in Lebanon, Alan Leroy, told the UN Security Council in a closed-door meeting Thursday that the explosion proved there was a serious violation of the resolution ending the 2006 war between Israel and Hezbollah. The United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon, UNIFIL, monitors the resolution, which calls for southern Lebanon to be free of Hezbollah arms. In a statement today, Leroy said that there were a number of indications suggesting that the arms depot explosion last week occurred at a, quote, active Hezbollah weapons depot, end quote. In the days following the explosion, Lebanese villagers at the site twice turned away a UNIFIL investigation team. Stones hurled by the villagers injured 14 UN personnel. Jackson Allers, FSRN, Beirut.
In England today, authorities announced 100,000 new cases of swine flu in the past week. This is an almost twofold increase over the previous week and a nearly 70 times increase over the number of new cases just a month ago. In the Middle East, Arab health ministers have banned children, the elderly, and the chronically ill from going on the Hajj, the annual Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca in Saudi Arabia. In the U.S., the number of new cases of swine flu is relatively low. By latest counts, nearly 3,400 new cases in the first week of July. But as summer ends, concerns about the continuing unavailability of a vaccine are surfacing. Speaking at a briefing Thursday, Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano says preparations continue.
A vaccine won't be available until October at the earliest, and schools in many states begin in just a couple of weeks. We've been planning all summer long for what happens when the school year starts, what happens when H1N1 comes back around into the United States, as the scientists predict that it will.
Bloomberg reports that Australia is the first country to have progressed to the clinical trial stage for the vaccine. Officials there hope to have the first batch of vaccines available within a few weeks. Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio has kicked off another so-called crime suppression sweep in and around Mesa, Arizona. Local and national activists say the sweeps racially target Latino residents in an attempt to capture undocumented immigrants. Otto Bogado reports.
The most recent sweep began Thursday and combines the efforts of Maricopa deputies, an armed civilian force, and deputies from neighboring Pinal County who just finished training under the 287G program. The program allows the Department of Homeland Security to enter into agreements with local agencies and authorizes local officers to enforce federal immigration law. Under new 287G guidelines, officers can only inquire about immigration status after someone is arrested and accused of a serious crime. But at a press conference yesterday, Sheriff Arpaio defiantly stated he will continue to arrest people solely on the basis of their status.
We have arrested 1,600 illegals that have not committed any crime other than being here illegally. So let's see what will happen with this new agreement that's coming up, and I got a gut feeling that we won't be able to do it anymore. So you know what? I'll make the decision whether to fire the federal government and get rid of our 287G, because the secret is we're still going to do the same thing.
The sweep continues through Saturday. Aura Bogado, FSRN, Phoenix.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
As the six-month deadline for the closure of Guantanamo Bay nears, lawmakers are still debating how they will deal with current and future detained enemy combatants. FSRN's Sam Greenspan reports from Washington.
One of Barack Obama's first acts as president was to issue an executive order requiring the closure of the Guantanamo Bay detention facility within a year. While many applauded the move, the administration and Congress are mired in debate over how to proceed. Buck McKeon, Republican congressmember from California, says he doesn't want detainees to be released into the U.S.
When I visited Gitmo on Monday, one of our briefers showed us a picture of a former detainee that was released because he was compliant and seemed to no longer pose a threat. It turned out we were wrong. He later blew himself up and killed 25 people in Baghdad. We've been wrong, according to DIA, 14% of the time. I fear we're getting it wrong in Iraq and Afghanistan, too.
McKeon met with other members of the Armed Services Committee on Friday to discuss the next steps for detainees of Guantanamo after the facility shuts down. He said he also wants a plan that denies habeas corpus to high-value detainees. Habeas corpus, the right to know the reasons for being detained, has been one of the most contentious issues with the detention process at Guantanamo. Some detainees at Guantanamo have been able to successfully sue in federal courts for habeas corpus rights, but this may change under a new system after the closure of the prison. Assistant Attorney General David Chris said enemy combatants should be subject to a specialized trial system.
Article III courts, which have unquestioned legitimacy, are also effective in protecting national security, and military commissions, as we propose to reform them, which have unquestioned effectiveness, are also fair and legitimate.
Jeanette Mentry is the Director of Terrorism and Counterterrorism with Amnesty International.
If the president is trying to close Guantanamo, that we have a court system that everybody recognizes free and fair. Trying people in military commissions has not been very effective. And for the Senate to try and bring back military commissions, Amnesty would say is fundamentally flawed.
Mentry also points out that the closure of Guantanamo should signify a shift of policy and attitudes, and not just the closing of one particular detention center.
There have been some really worrying signs over the last few weeks and months that the administration thinks that in order to close Guantanamo, it needs to bring in some form of prolonged or preventative detention. Amnesty has always consistently said that closing Guantanamo is not just about a physical location, but it's also about a system and a policy which you have going forward. And that if all they were going to do is basically close down a facility in Guantanamo and basically bring people to the United States under those conditions, then Amnesty would be very concerned.
Members of the Armed Services Committee don't expect to close Guantanamo by the end of the six-month timeline set by President Obama. Sam Greenspan, FSRN, Washington.
Three cabinet officials testified before Congress in favor of the stimulus. They trumpeted the projects and programs the stimulus is funding, but they didn't talk much about jobs. Some Republicans say the spending package hasn't created jobs fast enough. Tanya Snyder reports.
The secretaries of Agriculture, Transportation, and the Interior agreed that the stimulus money is getting out to where it's needed. They say that without it, the economy would be far worse than it is now. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar told the story of a company called DLM Contracting in Bozeman, Montana.
This year, there was no work for the employees at DLM. They bid on 20 jobs last winter and got none. They got none. Since then, they have won two Recovery Act bids, including a $71 million road project in Theodore Roosevelt National Park in North Dakota. They've hired workers. They're getting moving again.
The stimulus isn't just about big infrastructure projects, according to Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack. It's also about families making ends meet.
33 million Americans are today receiving the benefits of increased food assistance payments. If you spend any time at all in food banks, as I have, you will see that the additional emergency food assistance that the Recovery Act provided is really helping a lot of families have nutritious meals, particularly for America's children.
The secretary's success stories met with some skepticism. Paul Ryan, the top Republican on the budget committee, worries the stimulus plan isn't living up to its promise.
The administration said the key goal of the stimulus package was to save or create millions of jobs. Clearly, that hasn't happened. The unemployment rate is already at 9.5%, a 25-year high. The administration continues to promise that we will see results soon and that we need to give the stimulus more time to work. But most experts are predicting a so-called jobless recovery.
The secretaries even got some grief from Democrats. Committee Chair John Spratt of South Carolina said 28% of the stimulus dollars have gone out so far.
Main Street America, people are still saying, I don't see the relief yet. I don't feel it.
Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood says that's not the story he's hearing.
Everywhere I go, I see orange cones all over America, and I see thousands of people working. And I talk to these people. All of these people that I talk to, without exception, we're on unemployment in January and February and March, and they're working today. They're building roads, they're building bridges, they're building runways at airports.
But across the country, in school districts and clean energy companies and local governments, people are still waiting for the stimulus money to appear. Larry Florin is director of intergovernmental affairs for Napa County, California. He says there's been a lot of frustration about the mysterious rules governing the programs.
It's been, I think, despite the attempts for there to be transparency, and there's this almost feels like a black box of where the money is, and then all of a sudden one day there's an announcement that says, okay, now we're ready for you to apply, and here are the rules under which you can apply.
Florin says the process has been flowing more smoothly in the last few weeks, and money is beginning to be available. All the secretaries tried to emphasize that the money is getting out to projects all over the country. But Secretary Salazar said the Interior Department has so far allocated $305 million, just 10% of its share of the stimulus. LaHood says nearly half the transportation funds have been made available, and Vilsack says only 1/7 of the Agriculture Department's money has been distributed, but he explained that much of that money is nutrition assistance funding that has a 5-year time span. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
The federal minimum wage goes up to $7.25 an hour today. The increase is welcome news to minimum wage earners, but not all low-wage workers will benefit. On the line is Raj Nayak of the National Employment Law Project. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
First, who's being left out of today's minimum wage increase?
Well, so we're all excited that the minimum wage is going up today, but over 3 million tipped workers around the country are getting left behind again. The tipped worker minimum wage has now been $2.13 for the last 18 years. That's since 1991 at the federal level. And so this is like, you know, workers like the waitress at your local diner, the folks who clean your car at the car wash, and the list goes on. It's a lot of these service sector jobs that are fast-growing, that are jobs where increasingly Americans are spending their careers in our economy.
Wages for tipped workers used to be tied to minimum wage standards. How did that change, and what was the reason for separation?
For years, the minimum wage for tipped workers was a set percentage of the overall minimum wage. It started at 50%, and in the 1980s, it went up to 60% of the full minimum wage. Unfortunately, in 1996, Congress froze the minimum wage for tipped workers when they increased the minimum wage then to $5.15. And so now this minimum wage for tipped workers has been stuck at $2.13 since April of 1991. A lot of folks say it's true that minimum wage workers are supposed to get the full minimum wage after tips are included. So they get a base wage of $2.13, but then they're supposed to make up now the full $7.25 after they get tips. The problem is the tips are really notoriously hard to count on. You know, they can vary from season to season and shift to shift. And even so, the intent of this minimum wage for tipped workers was actually to provide tipped workers a little bit of a boost over the minimum wage, to make tipped jobs something closer to living wage jobs. And over the years, because we've continued to lose value to inflation, you know, that's very much harder to do now.
Is the minimum tipped worker wage standard for most states? Do some pay more, or do some even pay less?
The good news is that a bunch of states have actually taken the lead on this. 32 states now have minimum wages that are at least a little bit above what the federal level is at $2.13. And in fact, 7 states have set the minimum wage for tipped workers at the full minimum wage for their state. And, you know, I hasten to add that in those states there are thriving, you know, restaurant industries and other service industries. So, you know, it's not that we have evidence from states, you know, not just states like California, but also states like Minnesota, Montana, Nevada, that have raised their minimum wage up to the full level of the minimum wage for tipped workers up to the full level of the state minimum wage, you know, and have thrived. And there are states that have a lower minimum wage for tipped workers than federal level. The good news for workers in those states, and those states are like, you know, New Jersey, Virginia, Georgia. The good news for workers in those states is that if you're employed in those states and you're covered by both the federal minimum wage and the state minimum wage, you have to earn, you know, the greater of the two. So many, if not most, of those workers are at least covered by the federal minimum wage of $2.13.
In the report you co-authored for the National Employment Law Project, you argue that women are disproportionately affected. Explain.
That's absolutely true. I mean, we have this sub-minimum wage that's applicable to tipped workers only. And it turns out that 62% of tipped workers are women, and 72% of restaurant servers are women. And that's according to an analysis we did of current population survey data.
What do you recommend for improving the situation of tipped workers?
Well, we think a great first step would be for states in the federal level to go through and actually tie the minimum wage for tipped workers back to the full minimum wage, restore its value. You know, at starting to, you know, to 60%, which is where you know, where the federal minimum wage for tipped workers was at one time, and ideally to follow this best practice model that, you know, 7 states have implemented now, to actually have a minimum wage for tipped workers that's a full 100% of the minimum wage to guarantee everyone gets the full minimum wage from their employers, and then, you know, with tip jobs can start to become something closer to living wage jobs. They're great service industry jobs because they, you know, they're hard to outsource, and so we have the potential to create some good living wage jobs in this country.
Raj Nayak, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Raj Nayak is a staff attorney at the National Employment Law Project. Native tribes and environmental groups are gathering near the Grand Canyon in Arizona this weekend, calling for protections from proposed uranium mining in the area. Earlier this week, the Department of Interior ordered a 2-year ban on new mining and exploration. Tribal groups say the ban should include some 10,000 existing mining proposals as well. Christina Anistad files this report from Arizona.
The 2-year ban prevents new mining claims on an estimated 1 million acres of pristine forest land at the Grand Canyon, Arizona. But the ban does not apply to more than 10,000 existing mining claims near the Grand Canyon, including several uranium mining proposals in the works. That's why native groups are gathering at Red Butte, a sacred site to the Havasupai people, to oppose a uranium mine nearby. Roland Minakaja is with the Havasupai tribe.
It's a place where you can come to gather medicines. Some of our ancestors are buried here. This is lands where the thunder and the rain, the cloud beings, bring rain. and the drainages from this area go right into the Cataract Canyon, which goes into Supai, where we live now today. We're afraid that though the runoff, the tailings will head into the Havasu Creek and our people will suffer.
Uranium is mined for use in weapons and in generating nuclear power. Uranium mining proposals may be connected to the Obama administration's push for nuclear power, which advocates support as a way to combat global climate change. Energy Secretary Stephen Chu spoke before Congress earlier this month about the promise of nuclear power.
I think the nuclear power is going to be a very important factor in getting us to a low-carbon future. The Department of Energy is doing, with its tools, everything it can to help restart the American nuclear industry. With the loan guarantees, we're pushing as hard as we can on that.
Mine companies extract uranium using a practice called open pit mining. Water is mixed with cyanide and mercury to extract uranium from ore. Tribal and environmental groups say the chemicals could seep into the Colorado Basin and contaminate a source of drinking water for southwestern tribes and neighboring cities. The Navajo Nation banned uranium mining on its land in 2005 after witnessing the devastating effects on their land and people. Menakaja says the Havasupai Nation doesn't want to see uranium mining destroy their community, too.
A lot of our relatives, the Navajo Nation, Acoma, Laguna, some of the other tribes that have gone through this experience of mining companies invading their territories, a lot of them people are suffering from the respiratory and leukemia, cancer and whatnot. So we don't want to see that happen here. We don't want the eighth wonder of the world to be known as the eighth blunder of the world. We want it to be protected.
Meanwhile, the Obama administration is considering whether to ban new mining claims on public land near the Grand Canyon for 20 years. According to the Center for Biological Diversity, Canadian-based Denison Mines is proposing to reopen three mines for uranium extraction near the Grand Canyon. But these mining claims are existing, so they're exempt from the federal ban. Frank Quimby, a spokesperson for the Department of Interior, says because of the 1872 mining law, even Congress has limited powers.
Congress, of course, has the authority to permanently withdraw these lands from new mining claims, but not even Congress can void existing valid rights to mining. It's just not permitted by the law. The only alternative that I'm aware of is that Congress has the authority to legislate a buyout and then appropriate money to the department, and then the department would go in and negotiate with valid existing right claim holders to buy out their interest.
A new bill from Arizona Congressmember Raul Grijalva would do just that. The Grand Canyon Watershed Protection Act of 2009 would withdraw more than 1 million acres of federal lands from mining activities. There are also several bills in Congress that would reform the century-old mining law. Meanwhile, Denison Mines is waiting for the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality to permit their operation August 11th. Christina Onnestad, FSRN, Red Butte, Arizona.
In California, the defense attorney of a former Bay Area Rapid Transit police officer involved in the fatal shooting of 22-year-old Oscar Grant is seeking the dismissal of murder charges. The attorney claims the death was accidental, arguing that his client intended to fire his taser, but pulled the trigger of his gun by mistake. Meanwhile, BART governance has been slowly working towards a promise it made after the shooting to create a civilian body to oversee the BART police. As Andrew Stelzer reports, it's unclear whether Bay Area citizens will end up with any real power when that oversight body is finally passed into law.
We are Oscar Grant! We are Oscar Grant!
Soon after the street protests that followed the shooting death of Oscar Grant, BART announced that they would form a committee to look at creating a civilian group to oversee BART police. So far, one of the most hotly debated issues has been, will that civilian body have the power to recommend discipline of officers? And if so, who exactly could overturn that decision? Reginald Lyles, a consultant hired by BART to help with the process, was formerly an officer with the Berkeley Police Department and a captain with the Novato PD. Lyles notes that of three deaths in custody by BART police over the years, all three people killed were African-American males.
The citizens need to be involved in this particular case in BART because of the
what's driving this whole incident and their history. You cannot effectively police a community that does not trust its own police department.
But Jesse Sekhun, president of the BART Police Officers Association and a member of the committee designing the oversight board, says his fellow officers don't trust that citizens have the knowledge to evaluate police actions.
The perception out there is that they don't have that same training and are not exposed to what the everyday officer out there has to deal with and may not have the understanding of certain actions that we have to take as far as our own safety as well as the public safety.
Sekhun's preference is that the police chief or BART's general manager have the final say. Chief Gary G. agrees and told the panel developing an oversight proposal that citizens should not be involved in the disciplinary process.
I would question the ability of civilians to, without knowing the institutional history of a department, an officer's personnel file, specifics to a certain allegation, if it would be fair to the subject officer and to the department if the advisory panel were to be engaged in input as to discipline.
Skepticism about civilian oversight is widely held by cops across the country who fear being unfairly punished. But that fear seems to be unfounded. San Francisco's Office of Citizen Complaints sustained less than 9% of complaints over the last 15 years, and rates in other cities are typically well under 20% as well. And the police's resistance exacerbates the lack of trust, according to Reverend Daniel Buford, who's also on the subcommittee trying to design an oversight body.
If you got 95% purity on your police force, we'd like to see that other 5% out. And it messes with people when you're trying to protect the 5% or that little small percent that's the rotten eggs or the bad.
The proposal being prepared by the BART Board Subcommittee in its current draft form has a multi-layered appeals process. A citizen's complaint would go to an independent police auditor who investigates the incident and recommends action to a civilian oversight board. That action could range from dismissal to a short suspension to firing the officer in question. BART's police chief then either accepts that decision or can appeal it to the BART general manager and could appeal a second time to the BART board of directors, which has final say. That proposal still has to be brought to the community for feedback. Meanwhile, state legislation creating civilian oversight of the BART police is waiting in the wings. Assemblymember Tom Amiano drafted AB 312, a law that would install a model similar to San Francisco's Office of Citizen Complaints, a system that has its critics but is still considered one of the strongest in the area.
There will be community oversight, period.
Amiano's communications director, Quentin Mecki, says that despite lobbying by the Peace Officers Association in Sacramento, he believes AB 312 will pass if BART doesn't develop an acceptable proposal on its own.
The police unions understand that. What they're trying to do is get away with doing the least amount possible. What I think they're completely unappreciative of the fact is the level of damage that's been done trust-wise, relationship-wise.
It will still be several months before any oversight proposal becomes policy, and it's highly unlikely the BART police oversight body will receive any complaints before 2010. Andrew Stelzer, Oakland, FSRN.
That wraps it up for today for Free Speech Radio News. Today's newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp and Vinod K. Jones. Headlines editors are Jess Burns and Nell Abram. Tanya Snyder was today's Washington editor. The technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Pucklow, Rose Katapchi, and Janine Etter. In Oaxaca, Mexico, I'm Shannon Young, sitting in for Manuel Rueda.